Today, we are talking Knock.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Talkin' Knock. I am your host, Tristan, joined by the Shucker Supreme himself, Payton. How you doing, Payton?
Well, I'm actually kind of sad because you won't let me play RuneScape while I do this.
Correct. And instead, this will probably be the episode where Talkin' Knock dissolves because we're going to argue about one of these articles because it's my favorite and you hate fun.
I don't hate fun. I just hate this version of fun.
So, as a reminder, we are doing Knock Issue 1 again by Olivia Revenue and Eric Nyden. A little bit of housekeeping today. We have social media, as per usual. It's Talkin' Knock at whatever you want, and it's there's no G on there as well, as a reminder. We also now have a hashtag for asking questions directly to us. You don't have to worry about email or sending us a DM or anything. You just do hashtag TKQuest, and I check that regularly and can pull questions from there as well. So what's new with you? What are you doing in RPGs? Have you replaced your group yet?
Yeah, we brought in a new friend, and I don't know if he's played before, but he just kind of gave me a generic elf fighter and just said, roll with it. And I'm like, all right. And he's basically been the forerunner and everything, getting trial by fire.
Awesome. Does he seem to be picking up everything well and like synergizing with the group well?
Yeah. I mean, my group is a little meme-y compared to most. So it took him a few rounds of, you know, a little bit of fisting for him to get used to it. But after that, it was fine.
Nice. I love that. So what I've been doing is basically our DCC session that we have every week. We just finished my favorite module, which is the Web of All Torment. And it went as great as I could expect it to go. I was really happy with how it all went, and I think you guys had a good time too.
Yeah, the realization that Groundhog Day ended a lot sooner than we thought it did. You know, maybe wouldn't have played so fast and loose with everything and came out at the end with 1 HP each, but it ended okay.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, you guys literally did have one HP each, so it worked out. It just almost didn't work out.
Yeah, we almost let everyone died.
Yeah, almost, but not quite. In addition to that, I also played Mothership again this weekend. I'm kind of gearing up for the session that we're running on the 26th. I'm running Mothership for our DCC group and then also for the Kickstarter to drop on November 2nd. And it is actually fortuitous that we are talking about Mothership because Sean McCoy, the author, wrote one of the articles that we're talking about today.
Yeah, he wrote the article that we're going to split up over.
Exactly. He wrote the one that we're going to hate each other over immediately. But I mean, I guess without further ado, let's get right into it. So our first article slash two articles, I wasn't quite sure. They're both by Chris McDowell. They both have the exact same graphic design. And also, neither of the titles look bigger than the other. So I wasn't sure which one was the main title. And so either way, it's either Expose Your Prep and Encourage Scheming. But we're going to talk about Expose Your Prep first and then go into Encourage Scheming. So Payton, do you want to talk about Expose Your Prep first? Give a little rundown of what it is.
Yeah, so this article just mostly seems to... It kind of, you know, the beginning sentence is, you've heard the phrase, attack every part of the character sheet by Arnold Kay. And let's flip that and see how the players can capitalize on every bit of your prep. So, you know, it just basically goes into ways about how you can reward the players with bits of future advantage about whatever module or future knowledge, but to give them advantage about whatever module you're in. And I mean, I don't know. Most of the games that I play in a tabletop setting already do this, so it just seems like common knowledge to me.
Yeah, I tend to do this for you guys. I don't really hide much of the map unless it's like secret rooms or anything like that, so I don't deal with this. In addition, like, he goes into expose the map, expose the NPCs, expose the future, expose the tables, and expose the mechanics. So this is written by Chris McDowell, like I said, who wrote Electric Bastion Land, and also he has Into the Odd Remaster up on Kickstarter. As of the time of this recording, it's got another 8 days on it, so check that out if you're interested. I'll put a link in there. I don't know who did the art for any of these. They're kind of uncredited. It's just like a picture of an eye and a picture of a fox wearing a suit, so I'm not sure what that is. They might also be by Chris McDowell. I'm not 100% sure. But his first point that he makes is expose the map. So he basically gives you a blank map, which is what I do. I don't know if you do that in your games, do you?
Sometimes it's a blank map, sometimes it's Theater of the Mind, sometimes it's, you know, just a map with the NPCs hidden. Really, it's whatever I could put the effort into that day.
Yeah, I get what you mean. And it's nice, too, because when you do that, you get to spend less time worrying about explaining how stuff spatially relates to each other and instead be like, okay, this is the room you're in now. Here are the exits to that room and kind of reveal it as you go. I tend to do that, or I'll do like, hey, here's the full area like I did today with if you know it, then you get it kind of thing.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, that's usually what I do too with my people, depending on whatever medium I'm using.
Yeah, and he talks about exposing the NPCs as well. So basically, if you spend the time to figure out stuff about an NPC, yeah, you get all the info about them. And I even take this a step further normally in my games, and I'll like tell you the armor class and how much hit points they have left, because I feel like that is just something that you're going to figure out on your own. And instead of spending the time worrying about that, I'm just going to tell you. So, hey, you know how much luck to burn or anything like that when we play.
Yeah, and I guess personally, when it involves roles that would go against me, like you said, the luck thing, I would like to know exact values. But when it comes to, he says, like, show them their HP, that kind of stuff, I guess I kind of like how Fantasy Grounds does it, where like thematically it's like it's wounded, then they're heavily wounded, then they're dead. Like, I wouldn't go as far as to tell them exact values, but I do like the idea here.
Yeah, that's probably a better idea, is saying, hey, they're bloody or whatever you call it in your game, and then, hey, they're about to die kind of thing. In addition, he talks about exposing the future, which is basically, hey, what is going to happen if we don't do anything. And that's always good to let your players know, so that, I guess, I mean, it's pretty short and sweet, just so they know what the risk versus reward is for anything that they're dealing with.
Yeah, I like this in like a contained sandbox idea, and like I agree that you could probably do this to some extent anywhere. I just would be a bit too careful with being liberal with this, because then it would devalue someone, say, picking a spell like Second Sight.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I feel like when you do something like that, it also kind of takes away some of the like surprise factor, if you want that. So it just depends on the situation.
Yeah, I mean, like if there's a bit of surprise factor, but you know, your party puts a huge amount of investment into it, you can tell them like for a few things, like what your surprise is going to be and reward them, but you don't have to make that the standard if you don't.
Yeah, agreed. And he's got two more for this. So he's got expose the tables and expose the mechanics. Both of these I kind of feel like are tied together, because tables are just part of the mechanics and stuff like that. And how do you feel about these two?
I just, you know, like I said, with the expose the NPC thing, I get the idea thematically, and I think that there are certainly ways you could work this in that would get this idea across. I just wouldn't show the actual maps.
Yeah, like for instance, for us, this kind of ties into both of them, because we have different home rule death saves, which are a lot to explain right now, but basically it's you can spend stats to keep yourself alive, and you roll in an injury table every time you go down, even if you keep yourself alive. And so that's like very clear with you guys, but I wouldn't necessarily reveal the mechanics behind, say, the creature that was hunting you today, because I felt like it was much more impactful for you to not know how she was hunting, what she was rolling, all of that kind of stuff to find you all, and how long, for instance, your ward portals were lasting in reality, despite how much the spell said they were going to last, you know?
Yeah, and I guess that also kind of plays into, like, you know, once you put a ward portal down and she goes through it, you kind of get an idea, you know, like, this is how fast she would go through it relative to her strength. So you would find that out after a try or two anyway. So, you know, like, just let him try and see how it plays out.
Yeah, it definitely felt more impactful for you to be like, ah, she gets out this quick, so this is about how much time we have. Let's get a move on kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really all I have on this one, too. So if you're down to move on to encourage scheming, I'm down.
Yeah, I just overall thoughts, I pretty much agree with everything other than maybe showing a few actual values here and there. And like I said, that's because this is how most of the games I'm in are ran anyway. So I thought this was just how stuff works.
Yeah, it kind of worked out well because I was doing those things already and I was your kind of main tie-in. So I was doing this before I read Nock. So once I read this, I was like, oh yeah, that's just what I do.
Yeah.
His second article or second page or whatever you want to call it is titled Encourage Scheming. And basically it's planning and preparation can be fun parts of the game, but how do you encourage that with loosey-goosey systems like Into the Odd? Again, Into the Odd, it's his game, but you can apply this to anything. And I really like this one, kind of first thoughts. It's a lot of heist mechanics, which are always really fun and really tie into stuff like Lankmar and other games or settings like that as well. And it just seemed like a good time.
Yeah, I usually play some form of a thiefy character in games. So modules and stuff like that that play into the article we're about to talk about, where it lets you plan out heisty stuff, I always love.
It doesn't even need to be a specific heist, but just like giving you guys a little bit of forewarning to be like, all right, I want to set up a trap for this thing that's coming towards us, or how are we going to deal with this problem that we're running into? And I think that he gives a lot of good tips in his 3 points, which are necessity to plan, opportunity to plan, and ingredients for the plan. So why don't you talk about necessity to plan a little bit?
Well, necessity to plan just basically talks about, you know, maybe shifting your encounter design to something that if the characters or player characters plan ahead, they would get an advantage in the encounter. And I, like I said earlier, you pretty much do this most of the time, it would make sense. So this is just all I've experienced, and it's what I do to my players, but yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and he gives really good examples where it's like, hey, how can my players deal with this? And it's like, a dungeon where force field blocks all non-organic matter. So how are you going to get through? Like covering yourself in some type of metal sheet or something so you can push yourself through? I don't know if that'll work. It's one of those things where you can test out stuff and plan ahead for it.
Something you really have to plan on the spot too. So you can have like self-contained session ideas of progression where the knowledge might carry on in this module, but you can't like just bring in like this god hero that can do it with all the saves he has.
Exactly. And you've got to give your players an opportunity to plan, which is basically about making sure that there's time in the session for them to be like, all right, what are we going to do? And so I tried to do this today with you guys. I actually took a lot from this subsection specifically today when I was running it, because you guys were constantly being hunted by this creature. And I kept giving you enough time to stop and regroup and be like, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to try and trap her in here? And you guys obviously came up with the idea of ward portaling her, which is a spell in DCC, which allows you to get rid of a doorway for a certain amount of time, or kind of deciding this is the moment where we're going to confront her because we're feeling good, let's go do this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I kind of liked also the idea of maybe giving your players a time limit to plan, kind of like this module did. So that, you know, like if you're in the middle of, I guess, say a heist or whatever, since that's the example we've been using, and realistically, you would only have like 10 minutes to do this before you get caught, you know, maybe play into that. And if they just stand there doing nothing, they get caught.
Exactly. And what I've found to work the best, especially with my players, is there tends to be a lot of, okay, we just got out of this encounter, let's stand here and heal a bunch. And I'll allow, like, instead of doing a hard time limit where I'm like, okay, 10 minutes of real time or 10 minutes of game time or anything like that, I just make that simpler and I'm like, all right, I'll allow them to do 2 actions, then something is going to happen that either pushes them along or clues them into, hey, if we stick around, some more crap is going to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then if you do it that way, you know, you give them, put the burden of risk versus reward on them, where, you know, do they keep doing what they're doing or do they maybe start getting the hint and leaving?
Yeah, and it makes it so much easier on the judge GM side of things, because you're not worried about counting time. You're just like, okay, that's an action, bam, let's go kind of thing.
Yeah, because, you know, realistically, you would sit there and maybe plan 5-10 minutes and then do an action. So having the actual just set like clock ticking down, it's just so stressful.
Agreed. And you need to make sure that your players have ingredients for the plan, like Chris said, which basically is saying, what are the items that they can use for this heist? Is it their spell repertoire? Is it a specific item? Is it something like this? Some way that they can use their environment or their character to deal with whatever they're about to run into.
Yeah, and I like some of the examples he gives. Like one of them is a wealthy benefactor offers the complete service of his staff on your expedition, but they're mostly just house servants. Because, you know, it kind of plays into the idea of you have this power for this heist and you can prepare for this heist, but everything after is going to be gone. So, you know, do you maybe sacrifice a few people to get what you want done for lower morality? Or do you maybe not get the reward if it means that you save everyone? It kind of plays into, you let the players decide how evil they're going to be and whether they're going to die.
Yeah, for sure. And I love that. And it really gives a lot of agency to the players, which I'm all for. And it makes the players kind of push the story on their own without me having to be like, all right, guys, what are you doing in this situation kind of thing? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you know, every single time they go off on their own tangent, that means that you can have a plan tangent that you were going to use and put it in another session, and it's less planning.
So our next article is Why Setting High Stakes Matters by Sean McCoy, who most of you probably will at least have heard of through Mothership, which is an awesome RPG. It's space horror, and it's something that I love. I've been having a good time with. It's going on Kickstarter because they finally come out of like the playtest period and are going to be going to the full version of the game, which will be coming out November 2nd, I believe, is when the Kickstarter starts. And I will put a link to the Notify Me page on Kickstarter about that. And, you know, I think this might be where Talk and Knock ends, depending on what Peyton says next.
Well, you know, you seem to like this article. You like Mothership, which is also by Sean McCoy. And I've never played Mothership. I'm sure it's a great game and I look forward to it. But a lot of the stuff in here, I don't agree with.
You know what? Why don't you give me your opinion so I can tell you why you're wrong?
Well, I guess like the general TLDR of this article is that he just wants to get across the point that, you know, like having higher stakes to player actions matters, which I agree with, except a lot of how he says to go about it is to use random dice rolls, because he says it adds player agency and takes away the arbitrary nature of having them always succeed or fail. And I guess I just happen to think that instead that having everything you've done lead up to a random dice roll is the more arbitrary option.
See, so you took that away from this, and I actually barely even read the paragraph where he talks about like the dice rolling versus the video game like version of determining it. And I think part of that comes from the fact that a lot of OSR games, and specifically Mothership, like Mothership has this directly in the rules, and it says you should not be rolling unless there is something like seriously stressing you out. So in Mothership, you can be a doctor and be running surgery, and if you've run the surgery 100 times, there's no reason why you should have to roll for that surgery unless, like, there's a creature coming down, you've got to get a bullet out of a person, like, in that moment. So I think more what he's saying is that he views the point where he's got to make the roll almost as him failing already, because then it's way more up to chance than if he would have come up with a plan that was a successful plan and shouldn't even have to go to the rolling, which is kind of a common theme in a bunch of OSR games. So that's, I think, where he's coming from with that. And I think from there, he just kind of moves on to talking more about, hey, having death as a stake is something. This is stake, STAKES, and not STEAKS. But having death as a stake is something where anything is on the table if you've got death on the table. So you can have injury, you can have your character being maimed in some way, because, hey, it's not death. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I guess, first of all, if he wants to kind of say that if you've gotten to the point where you have to roll, then it's a failure, then maybe he should have led on with that. But I guess even in your example, if the payoff of being a doctor and doing a surgery 100 times is still having to roll during panic, then like, what would be the point of being a doctor in the first
place? Yeah, and that makes sense. But at the same time, with Mothership and other horror games, you're not necessarily under any conditions that being a doctor can prepare you for. Like in our game, for instance, we've got these almost zombies, like they basically got coal dust in some way. I don't really know what's going on yet because I'm just a player in it and I didn't want to read ahead. So we've got like these zombies that have like coal dust in them that are just like killing and destroying people around them. And I'm a scientist and I'm supposed to be looking at like geology on the area, and you betcha I'm a geologist in real life, and there's no way that I would be able to look at anything related to my job if there was like a gross coal zombie chasing me down, you know?
Well, right, but I guess I counter that then to the point of, if you're in the type of setting where no backstory you have can lead you to the preparation where you wouldn't have to roll the dice, then all of that then would become arbitrary, which is what this is trying to avoid.
I guess, yeah, but I think that his point for mainly the dice portion that you're talking about is that he specifically says, I want my great plans to succeed and I want my shitty plans to fail. I want enemies to surprise me, and this requires an impartial referee, and of course, stakes that are sufficiently high that I care about the result. Like I was saying, I don't think that he even really mentions dice in here, except for the point where he says, if the results of my experience were always a success, or even success anytime I roll a 10 or more on a 2d6, my actions feel arbitrary. I think that's the only portion that he's ever talking about dice at all in here, and the rest of it is more about just having death and different stakes on the table. And I think he just is basically using that as an example where he's like, hey, if I always win, then that's not what I want. And I think it's more directed towards power fantasy games rather than the fact that, hey, using dice is better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I agree with the point you're making, and I agree with the framing of this. It's just, you know, he also, like you said, he says, this is all requires impartial referee. The stakes are sufficiently high that I care about the result, right? I guess I took that to be that, why would you try to do anything if if you don't care about the result, then you're not going to do it, in which case you're only going to roll the dice on high results, which is, I guess, to me, is the area where I would rather have the planning lead to an arbitrary success than do a bunch of planning and have it lead to a dice.
I get what you're saying. Yeah, no, I agree with where you're coming from that. And I think it's just a little bit of just not being clear in the beginning. But I think the main point of what he's talking about is just, hey, death needs to be an option. I'm pretty sure that this is kind of a shot at more power fantasy games from his side. Not necessarily a shot, but more just his own beliefs on it. And when you look at something versus 5th edition, he even says this specifically in here where he starts talking about making a huge backstory versus getting your backstory as a player. And he even mentions DCC, which is why we'll bring it up for the umpteenth time. But the funnel system in DCC, which is basically where you have these four level zero characters that are basically just peasants the whole time, you grow so much more attached to those characters when you get them through the funnel and you're like, oh my god, this guy finally survived. And it makes it feel more real because I also lost three other guys on the way here. So I'm used to the death. I know that it's a real thing. And these guys are actually heroes. And all it cost was the rest of their town who died trying to get here, you know?
Yes. I would actually like to offer you a counter train of thought to this.
Okay.
So he uses the DCC example in relation to characters, you know, being used to the idea of death at low levels, right?
Right.
Just because they would be used to the death of low levels doesn't, like you said, mean that they wouldn't get attached to their character, and thus would mean that, you know, death would still matter to them if it happened to them, right?
Right.
So if you have a person that has written up a bunch of backstory that cares about their character, like a person who would have done a funnel would, they would also have that same level of, like, fear of death around their character.
I think, too, what he's saying in addition to that is that, and this is actually my counterpoint as well, the difference is we're playing RPGs. It's meant to be a thing that we do as a group together. And if you like making backstories, that's fantastic. That's not necessarily why I'm playing these games. And I think the reason he's saying that is because DCC, when you get that attachment, you're getting that attachment by actually sitting down with your friends and playing that game. It's not like you're sitting at your house, unless you do like group writing sessions, which is totally fine, but you're sitting by yourself writing all that stuff up, and then you're bringing it to the judge or DM or GM or whatever, and you're like, this is what I made, instead of this is what we made, which is my whole reason for playing these games.
And I guess, yeah, I agree with you to a point, but just because of how, you know, we have always done, I guess, RPG sessions, is that, you know, there's always a session zero where, you know, even if you may not fully make your character, you're still sitting around with the group saying, I want to do this, I want to do that, blah, blah, blah. Like, granted, that's not going to have the same, like, lethality and suspense as a funnel, but it still does act as the same, like, session zero feel that would lead to the attachment to both the group and the party.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I think he even says that a little bit in his final paragraph, where he says, my point is, think hard about the stakes of your game. And he even mentions, like, hey, if you're a story gamer, are you putting enough risk in there that, like, the story actually feels fulfilling? And then if you're more challenge-oriented, are you putting the stakes high enough that clearing them is actually an accomplishment? I think he just mainly wants to caution people about making the game feel too dull after a while, because I definitely felt that when we did our 5th edition game, where we were running through a published module, which I don't want to slander anybody about, but it was a published module, and it just kind of was a slog, because we didn't really, there was no one to really care about the story with, and it was literally just cutting down waves of the same people over and over again, and there wasn't really any risk until someone just got one shot, and then it went back to having no risk, and it was like, okay, that really didn't feel warranted because nothing else has projected how scary this is. It's just one dude who was able to one-shot one of our characters and then we moved on.
Yeah, and I guess that's also just like a problem with like, not to slander anyone, but it's just like, when you want to introduce an important character, what do? You give them a difficulty spike. And it's just, modules that do that are not okay.
Yeah, it's just lazy writing. Oh, sorry, did we say we're not going to slander anybody?
Yeah, sorry, there's a fucking fly by my fucking head. Anyway, yeah, and I guess I see this a lot more in 5e modules than OSR modules, but that may also be because 5e modules are a lot more narrative focused, where OSR modules are a lot, you know, dungeon focused, so you don't have like the amateur people trying to make all the OSR modules, so maybe it's an issue with just how the games work, maybe it's not, I don't know, but the OSR has less of them, so it's a plus.
Yeah, agreed. And also, you're a little bit pampered because Goodman Games employs some fantastic writers, so that's what we've been going through a lot of.
I'm okay with that because I've been loving the module so far. You're not sponsored, by the way.
Not sponsored yet.
Yet.
Looking at you, Joseph Goodman.
You know, our socials are in the description, wink wink.
So, I mean, any final thoughts with that? Like, I think we pretty much covered it. It's one of my favorites personally. It's how I run most of my games. I can see what you're talking about in it that you're focused on. I don't necessarily use that, so it doesn't really affect me. I just focus more on the... I mean, it's the whole way that I explain OSR to people. It's high stakes rather than high lethality.
Yeah, and I agree with everything else in the article, you know, like with the whole not just using death as a fail state. I mean, one of my favorite go-tos is like, go, hey, kill the wrong guy during a quest. Everyone hates you now. Good luck.
Yeah, like, that can be almost more devastating than a character death sometimes. Or, for instance, you guys today fought those things that resembled your friends, and now you're having a hard time looking at your friends who you've known since the beginning of it, and it's, like, actually messing you up a little bit. Stuff like that. When you have death on the table, the world is your oyster, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like doing it this way also can kind of... there are those people who were just use their characters as tokens and make them OP and do whatever they want with them and just, you know, keep rolling up OP stuff. You know, you may, instead of killing the character, you know, knock their stats down a bit, make them a little ugly, that kind of stuff. Still keeps them going. Punishment is definitely worse than death for them.
Yeah, and it definitely feels like your adventurers are actually adventurers instead of just, like, Greek heroes who never really get injured, you know?
Yeah, but have you seen how our party plays? We may be a bit as homoerotic as the Greek adventurers.
This is true. So, our last article today is another one of these wonderful tables that they put out, and this one is called What's the Deal with Igor's Hump?
Okay, Mr. Seinfeld.
Oh yeah, Jerry Seinfeld, who is probably not the best anymore, but I don't know, I haven't really looked into him for too long. But anyway, it's by Jack Shear, who runs a really nice blog that has been honestly super active since all the way back in 2012. It's called Tales of the Grotesque and Dungeonesque, which is a mouthful, but I honestly think it's worth it. It's really easy to read. He's got great graphic design in that it does not hurt my eyes to look at his blog like it does with some people's blogs. So I'm a big fan of that.
I haven't personally looked at his blog, but you know, if it, not to knock anyone here, but hey, get it, knock.
Are you Jerry Seinfeld?
Yes, I am. If your blog, you know, has any kind of graphic design from after 2005, then it's a plus in my book.
Yeah, there are a lot of blogs out there where I open it up and I'm like, oh, that is some pink.
Yeah, you know, old GeoCities vibes.
Exactly. So this one basically is a D10 list of all of these creatures that he basically says there's three facts. All mad scientists have a hunchbacked assistant. That assistant is always named Igor or Igor. And fact number three is this is what's going on with his hump. And then it's the 10 hump types. So why don't you, do you have a favorite in this one?
So I think that they are all equally great. However, I have, I guess, an anti-favorite. One that I don't like.
Oh, which one don't you like?
I like number 10, or I don't like number 10, Tentacle Cluster, which is Igor's hump is a gift from the demon lord Zorch. It can sprout a multitude of tentacles to attack with. While the tentacles do no damage on their own, they possess the paralysis ability of a cadaver grub.
What don't you like about that?
I just don't like that because I have seen enough anime to know where this is going.
Yeah, I'm not a... I feel like tentacles are a little bit overused at this point, but it's just because they elicit a very, like, response from everybody, so everybody uses it. I mean, hell, I've used them for stuff. I think my favorite is the psychic brain, which is where his hump has a second brain that possesses the mind blast ability of a brain lasher. I just think that's wonderful that he's got a whole ass other brain in his shoulder that's just, like, blasting out stuff the whole time.
Yeah, you know, like, maybe he's not really Igor. Maybe he's just Igor the puppet.
Igor the puppet, yeah, of the second brain, you mean?
Igor the puppet of the second brain that communicates through psychic blasts.
Oh, there you go. It's actually just trying to talk to you, and you just can't understand it because of your puny human brain.
Exactly. You know, who cares about the fact that you might die? Just wants to say hello.
Exactly. So, we have a listener question this week, and it's a good one. I think it's going to take us a bit of time to get through. So, it's from my buddy Landon, who's a friend of the pod, and he asked, for those game masters who typically run OSR-style games, how much of the OSR do they use in their game, and what OSR games do they typically leave out? And I think this is kind of a multifaceted question, because I think we kind of got to sit down and think what we really are putting in the OSR game, and what we consider part of this OSR idea, and what is just specifically something that we've picked up, you know?
Yeah.
So do you want to give me a hit at what you think OSR is, and then I'll give one, and we'll kind of narrow down what we think for this, for the purposes of this question and what we're using.
I guess to me, I think the OSR generally at a high level stands for more freeform stuff over the more focused narrative shifted stuff of newer D&D game.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it does have that freeform ability to it. And then also it goes into more of the location-based stuff. It doesn't have to, but I feel like that's a pretty high part of it, is like, we are in this dungeon this time, and we're focusing on that. I feel like the dungeons are bigger most times than some of the newer stuff. I know that in both the Pathfinder and 5th edition kind of starter modules that they give you, the dungeon really isn't that long. It's like 5 rooms total, whereas we've had some that are like 4 different areas, and you're dealing with all these things going on in different areas. But I kind of think that there's like a high location-based narrative that kind of goes on, you know?
Yeah, I kind of feel like that's also kind of has been a problem in not only tabletop RPGs, but just like video games and other stuff in general, where dungeons have become less and less about what they used to be and more just something that you can go into that may be off the beaten path that has loot.
Yeah, and I totally get what you mean. So I think those ones, and then I also think like kind of the gonzo nature of not understanding everything that's going on. I think part of the draw of the nostalgia that people get from OSR comes from never knowing what's going to be around the next turn, instead of this is a goblin, this is an orc, I will now fight this because I know that it is evil. Whereas what we're going through in OSR games, it's like this is a multi-dimensional beam that we just don't understand in any way, and it's trying to communicate through us through warping at us and stuff like that. So I think the gonzo aspect is a pretty big part of it.
Yeah, and I think that doesn't necessarily even have to apply to the enemies, you know, like in D&D it's like how many times could you play rogue without getting bored? But in DCC, you know, by the time you hit level 2, you know, maybe you've gone through a few modules that permanently change your character to something different, and it happens every time.
Yeah, I think the characters are definitely squishier in OSR games as well.
They're a lot squishier, but at the same time, I also feel like that is also applied to a lot of the enemies.
Yeah, agreed. The enemies don't have a ridiculous amount of XP where you're just like a ridiculous amount of HP where you're just like chipping away at them for combat that takes an hour and 15 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
So I think the main ones that we got that I think that both of us really use in our games as well. There's definitely other stuff in the OSR movement that we're not covering here, but the stuff that we pick up a lot on is the freeform aspect of it, the location-based adventures and location-based, like, just stuff that we're dealing with the whole time, the gonzo weird stuff that goes on, and then kind of the character and enemies are a lot more... There's high lethality, like exactly what we're talking about, but it's high lethality in the mindset of using it as higher stakes, you know?
Yeah.
Ah, gotcha. See, you agreed to the article, so I won.
I agreed with the premise of the article, just not the examples used.
Okay, that's fair. I'll take that. You know what? I'll take that as an absolute win.
I'll let you have that.
So next week, we're only doing 2 articles. We've got Some Ways of Killing D&D People, and rulings, not rules, is insufficient. And we're actually going to have a guest next week who I will not reveal yet because he's a friend of mine. But yeah, we'll have a guest next week to talk about those two articles.
Oh boy, I love secret guests.
You have the spreadsheet. You can see who the guest is.
Well, yeah, but if I don't look, then I'm just as excited as the viewer.
All right, that's fair. Well, unless you have anything else, my friend?
No, I'm good.
All right, well, we will see you next week, everybody.
Yep, see y'all next time.